Okay, well, if you remember last week, we had started into chapter 44. 44 or 45, where am I? What's that?
Is it recorded on?
Yes, sir, it is. Thank you. I just turned it on. No, he's good. We were in chapter 45, and we got started into it, and then we took a little overview of verses 4 to 15 by way of some questions, but then we paused for this little excursus on the problem of evil. So what I want to do this week is kind of circle back to verses 4 to 15. We'll kind of exposit our way through that. We'll see how far we get into chapter 46, and then we'll just kind of pick things up as we go from there. So if you remember, the structure of the chapter was the first three verses, what I call the stunning reveal and reaction, part one. And this is when Joseph reveals himself to his brothers. This is followed by the startling grace and reconciliation in verses 4 to 15. So I said that the appeal that was made by Judah was quite masterful at the end of chapter 44. And now we see an equally masterful expression of grace from Joseph as he reveals himself and assures his brother in these verses. This is followed by the solicitous bounty, 16 to 20. So this is where our friend Pharaoh gets into the act and wants to add some goodies for their trip back. And then because we have to come up with S's, the swag, I would have gone with bling, but you know, we got to stay on the S theme. So the swag, which is akin to bling. So the additional swag for the journey, or the equipping that Joseph provided for his brothers and his father. And I think there's a purpose in that. We'll take a look at that. And then finally, the stunning revelation and reaction, part two, as Jacob learns that his son Joseph is alive. So again, a pretty interesting chapter as we go through that. Now, Joseph's startling grace proceeds in three stages, and it starts with patient explanation in verses 4 to 8. So somebody please read those verses for me, verses 4 to 8 in chapter 45.
Then Joseph said to his brothers, "Please come close to me." And they came closer, and he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. Now don't be grieved or angry with yourself, because you sold me here, for God sent me before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. God sent me here before you to reserve you for you a remnant in the earth and to keep you alive by a great deliverance. Now therefore, it was not you who sent me here, but God, and he has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his household and ruler over all the land of Egypt."
Okay, thank you, Danae. So often what we see is that the one sinned against is the one that initiates the reconciliation, as Joseph does here in verses 48. Now notice also, as Matthew pointed out last week, Joseph is not reconciling himself to the brothers. He's reconciling the brothers to himself, which is in fact the way it works in salvation for us. God is at work to reconcile sinners to himself, not himself to sinners. It's an important distinction. Yet the sinner, those who have perpetrated the sin, is not relieved of being proactive, right? Because in the Sermon on the Mount in chapter 5, verses 23 and 24, we do get an admonition that if you are in the process of going to the altar and making a sacrifice, or even today as we were committing ourselves to the Lord's table, you know that you have sinned against the brother, you are called to be proactive about that. Particularly as you think about that in the context of the Lord's table, if we are taking the Lord's table in sin, we're bringing more sin down upon ourselves. So that's why it's important to reflect as we move through the Lord's table and the elements on sin that we may have and that we may need to confess. But often as we see reconciliation working itself out, it is the one who is sinned against who initiates the reconciliation. Now the process begins with Joseph's patient explanation to his brothers. He enjoins them to draw near in verse 4. So remember, this is kind of that imagery I talked about. It says, come near, probably in most of your translations. I like draw near, you know, draw near to God and he'll draw near to you. So he wants to draw them near to him. and he again reasserts his identity along with a zinger proof point. Now, what is the zinger proof point that he gives us in verse 4 about his identity?
Whom you sold into slavery.
Absolutely. He discloses the detail that only he and the other 10 would know, right? Okay, I'm Joseph. Oh, yeah, right. No. The one you sold into slavery. Okay, so not only a zinger. Can you imagine being on the receiving end of that? Okay, that's like a harpoon right in the heart when you think about it in terms of what's going on. So he offers this undeniable proof point to his brothers in the process. Now, in addition to the proof, what else is accomplished by this declaration on Joseph's part? In a small way, but something is accomplished in that.
The verbalization of the sin that was committed against him.
Exactly right. First time the sin is now publicly verbalized, okay? Now, the brothers have acknowledged it among themselves, right? And any of you that had siblings that have kind of conspired to eat the cookies or whatever and figure out how mom's not going to catch you, right? What do? You try to keep it to yourselves. But if you happen to have had Greek in-laws, there's a cookie called kufeta, which has like powdery dust on the bottom of it, on the outside of it. So you can't eat kufeta because it's always right there on your shirt. And you know. Now, if Linda was here, she would know what that was, Linda Chilakis. But, well, and so with Linda Bailey, right? Have you had kufeta?
Yeah.
The cookie?
Makes another thing called a kurumiyada.
Oh, yeah, kurumiyada. Yeah,
got
a crumbly things, and they're all on in front of your shirt. Okay, so that's right. Well, that's why God gives men tummies, so that you have something to catch the crumbs before they hit the floor. Okay, so you don't have as much cleanup in that regard. All right, so in addition to the proof, what else is accomplished? First time their sin is publicly verbalized beyond just brothers. Now, it was who was likely hearing this for the first time, though? Absolutely. Benjamin, right? I'm quite sure that they hadn't brought him in on what had happened. So you imagine what poor Benjamin is. He's the guy that fouled up and, quote, took the chalice, but now he's finding out for the first time what really happened to his blood brother. So it must have been an equally big shock to him as well. So this is part one of what's going to be more public exposure of their long ago sin. So it's going to come out again, okay, as we get to towards the end of this chapter. But you can see now God is going to expose sin. So why do we go ahead and confess sin? Why? Because if you don't, God's going to bring it out some way or another. And I guarantee you, it's always going to be more painful that way. So you think about that process in confessing sin. Okay, now, having called out their treachery, what comes next? What does Joseph do next?
Basically says, don't blame yourself, don't grieve, don't be angry, which is amazing.
It's absolutely amazing, isn't it? He formally forgives them and expresses it by way of an explanation, okay? So he's formally forgiving them, right? So what is the explanation? Okay, you said it. He affirms their sin. That's key, okay? He doesn't deny. He's like, you didn't really mean it. I know you didn't. No, he affirms the sin. But then he goes on and acknowledges that it's God's greater good. So, right, remember when we were talking about our questions last week, he said, kind of what's the pattern of Joseph? It's God, 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 God. 5, 6, 7, and 8, we see it. God, Joseph attributes things that are happening in his life to God. Okay, now stage 2 comes in verses 9 to 13. So I'm going to read those for me, please.
Hurry and go up to my father and say to him, thus says your son Joseph, God has made me Lord of all Egypt. Come down to me, do not tarry. You shall dwell in the land of Goshen, and you shall be near to me, you and your children, your children's children, your flocks and your herds and all that you have. There I will provide for you, as you and your household and all that you have come to poverty, for there are still 5 years of famine. And behold, your eyes and the eyes of my brother Benjamin see that it is my mouth that speaks to you. So you shall tell my father of all the glory in Egypt and all that you have seen. And you shall hurry and bring my father down here.
Okay, so what is Joseph now doing in this stage of his response? What's he doing here?
Hmm?
Okay, so he's providing concrete proof of his forgiveness, okay? He's forgiven them, but now he's really kind of adding in concrete proof to his forgiveness. How does he do that? What is the primary means he uses to give them proof of his forgiveness? What's he doing with them here?
Telling them, or protecting, giving them protection from the famine that's remaining.
Yeah, okay, so he's giving them reassurance. Okay, he's reassuring them. And then, Larry got it, what form does the reassurance take? Well, it takes the provision and protection for the family, right? Which is what? Fulfillment of the dreams all the way back in chapter 37, right? So here we come, full circle, okay? So he's proving out his genuine forgiveness by reassuring them again. So I love the first statement, but he keeps going on, right? He keeps going on reassuring them, okay? So again, amazing forgiveness on his part and amazing maturity. Now, where have you seen this kind of response to sin before? Okay, and I'll just help you with that. It happened somewhere before in Genesis, up to here. Where have we seen this kind of response to sin before? Kind of a gracious reassurance.
Esau?
Esau,
what?
Esau and Jacob.
Well, that's right. They certainly did. Go back up a little more. Is that what you're going to say, Kathy?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So turn back to Genesis 3, right? Genesis 3, right at the beginning, right? So what do? Right? They fumble, right? They eat the fruit, right? And, you know, what does God do in the midst of punishing them? He gives them assurance, right? So think of the last time you were executing discipline on your children, and between spanks, you were reassuring them, right? I mean, come on. Look what happens in verse 15. What's the first reassurance? Well, you know, there's going to be reversal. There's somebody who's going to come who's going to reverse this curse at one point in time. Pretty amazing reassurance. Down in verse 19, it said, by the sweat of your face, you will eat bread till you return to the ground, because from there you're taking your return to dust. Now, why is it a reassurance that they're going to return to dust?
That's where they came from.
That's where they came from, but what?
They won't live in that condition.
Absolutely, right? God's not going to make them live in their sin, okay? He's not going to make them live completely in that sin. So in verse 19, we see it. And then in verse 21, we see it again. The Lord made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them, right? So he's going to kick them out, but he's going to give them better duds as they go, right? I mean, yeah, Matthew.
So is this where the phrase comes from? After you spank your kid, you say, years from now, you'll thank me for
that? Yeah, I think so. That would be an implication of this text. So when you want to have an implication for this text, that's exactly where you go. So, you know, we see that kind of grace in God, right? At the very point that they sinned, not only is he punishing them, but he is providing reassurances in that we could even say that the naming of the woman, Eve, Chaya, which is to live, okay, is yet another subtle reassurance in the process. So there will be some form of living that will go on in the process. So in verses 14 to 15, then, we're going to see the final stage of the reconciliation. So somebody read those for me, please.
Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept, and Benjamin wept upon his neck, and he kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. After that, his brothers talked with him.
Okay, so kind of interesting. So what do we see in this final stage? What finally happens? Now, he's reached out in reconciliation. What are these final two verses telling us has occurred? Well, they're reconciled, yeah. Okay, so another R word for that.
Restored.
Yeah, they've been restored to fellowship, okay? So really, this is the whole ultimate purpose of all this. It's the purpose of what we saw this morning, okay? It's the restoration of fellowship. So again, you can think of this in a microcosm of your own children. You never stop loving them when they misbehave, but your fellowship or the quality of that fellowship is broken as they're misbehaving. As there's forgiveness and repentance and reconciliation, the outcome of that is a restored fellowship, okay? So what we see now in these final two verses is this reunion and restoration of the fellowship between the brothers. Now, How is it expressed, okay? It's expressed two ways. What are they? How do we see that this restoration has occurred?
By embracing and weeping.
Okay, so the first one is loving embrace, verses 14 to 15a, okay? So there's a loving embrace, there's a physical expression of their restoration, and the second one is what?
They're
what?
Talk.
Yeah, they're jibber-jabbering again. Talk time, right?
Fellowship after.
Yeah, there you go, fellowship after. Talk time, all right? So the fact of the matter is that they did that. Now, what do you think they talked about? Old times? Hey, you remember that time out in the wilderness when we threw you in the pit? What do you think they talked about?
Probably what you're doing with my coat.
Yeah. What's that? Yeah.
They probably brought Joseph more up to date on their father.
Well, they could have, yeah. And I like it. I think this one, what'd you do with my coat? Yeah, okay. That was good. Very good. What else? What's that?
Did they talk about the Father, maybe?
Yeah, and said that. Something else. I mean, what do you think? Yeah, Viv.
Maybe about God.
Well, yeah, okay, maybe about God. I think that's getting closer to it.
The next 5 years.
The next 5 years? Okay, the next 5 years of famine. When are you going to be serving for dinner? Yeah, okay. Now, look, I'm going to assert this is in the sanctified speculation category, okay, because it doesn't say, all right? But I would suspect that they finally confessed. You know, yeah, Joseph, we were wrong, and we got it all wrong. So I expect that because of what they finally understood, there probably was some confession. Now, we never really get anything that affirms that they absolutely confessed in this process, but they spent time talking, and it just seems to me that you would have to clear the air if you were going to come back to that kind of scenario. And it's laying their past animosity to rest, which is kind of interesting because the last time we heard about them, they were on such unfriendly terms that they couldn't even speak to him. Okay, so back in chapter 37 in verse 4, it says this. Chapter 3. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his sons because he was son of his old age. He made him a very colored tunic. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers. And so what? They hated him. And they couldn't even speak to him on friendly terms. So now we have this full cycle, right? What is it saying they're doing here at the end of this verse, right? And they talked with him, okay?
I think seeing as Joseph was Jacob's favorite,
right?
And then eventually Benjamin became his favorite.
Mm-hmm.
If I was Benjamin, I'd be looking at them guys, man, I don't think I want to go back home to see Dad.
Yeah, it's not good being the favorite, right? Absolutely. So, yeah, but maybe he has a few bad thoughts about Joseph, too. I'm going to have to compete for Dad's attention now. Yeah, but we see the fact that they've come back and did it. So, again, it's sanctified speculation. We don't know. Maybe they caught up on what happened. What's been going on in the last 22 years since I've been gone? How's Pop doing? Yeah, all that stuff probably true. But I suspect there probably was some clearing of the air as they have moved forward to that. Okay, so they're chatting away with Joseph. So somebody read verses 16 to 20 as we move along here.
When the report was heard in Pharaoh's house, Joseph's brothers had come. It pleased Pharaoh and his servants. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, say to your brothers, do this, load your beasts and go back to the land of Canaan and take your father and your household and come to me and I will give you the best of the land.
Okay, so Pharaoh is pleased to discover a means to honor and reward Joseph, and both he and his servants were obviously grateful for Joseph's leadership. Okay, so Pharaoh is pleased. Now, Pharaoh seems to be quite secure in his reign, in his magnanimousness here. And why would I say that? Why can we kind of assume that Pharaoh is very secure in his leadership in this?
Joseph
was a loyal servant, right? But because he would have a concern because bringing down Joseph's family could provide a conflict, but yet he had confidence in Joseph's loyalty in the process. So he's pretty secure, even though there could be kind of a competing faction, as the follow-on pharaohs were not, right? Yeah, Bobby.
Or do you think maybe Joseph would want to go back to his family now that they're all reconciled?
Yeah, he could think that, right. But he was secure, they would bring him back down. It could be insecure, yeah, I want to get him down here and make sure he keeps reigning through the process. Yeah, Matthew.
I would just point out, it seems to me, though, that also that Joseph's faithfulness, even when he was, can I use the word indentured servant, unsaved man, yet he realized he was working as under the Lord, and God blessed that and brought him to the place where Pharaoh, I think, recognized those years when he could have despaired. He could have said, why'd you leave me in this condition?
Right.
And yet he was faithful in the ministry that God gave him for such a time as this.
Yep, I agree. I agree. So you've got a lot of things that are kind of coming together and going on in the process. And again, I don't want to encourage you to go too far beyond the text, because I don't want you to start reading stuff into the text. But one of the things you need to do when you're reading Old Testament narrative in particular is to try to put yourselves in the shoes of the individuals. Try to experience the emotions along with them. The Bible is very emotive. It's got a lot of emotions going on, and just think it through in the context of how you might be reacting in those situations. So, yet Pharaoh is solicitous to Joseph, and what does he pledge to Joseph? What does Pharaoh pledge to give Joseph?
The best of Egypt.
The best of Egypt, okay, the land, okay, and the chow, okay, all you can eat, and the best of the land. An invitation to Joseph's extended household also, right? Bring them all down. Now, that may be a protective move to make sure he's got them all there and he's got no torn loyalty, but it's also a gracious thing to do. A place to live peacefully, the best of the land, abundant food supply, the fat of the land, and then wagons for transport, okay? So remember this. This is going to become important in a minute. He gives them these wagons for transport, okay? So that's what he promises to him, and he commands him to go do that, okay? So it's not like he's saying, hey, it'd be a great idea, go up and get your family. He tells them to go do it, okay? Now, household furnishings as well, don't concern yourself with any of your goods, right? So everything, don't worry about the spoons and the forks and the knives and the pots and the pans. We got it all down here. Come on down. And basically, an all-in-all magnanimous offer. The choicest property with stocked fridge, fully furnished homes for you and your extended family. Sounds like an offer that you can't refuse. Okay.
Well, that was promised when I moved to Florida.
You are. And did you receive it?
No.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you when you will receive it. When you make your ultimate move to glory, you will get all that stuff. Okay. So you have something to look forward to.
Sooner than later, please.
Okay, well, we'll see about that. Make sure your insurance is paid up if you're doing that. We'll make sure Beth's going to be okay when you're gone and so forth. Okay, so verses 21 to 24.
And the sons of Israel did so, and Joseph gave them wagons according to the command of Pharaoh, and gave them provisions for the journey. To each of them he gave changes of garments, with Benjamin he gave 300 pieces of silver and 5 changes of garments. To his father he sent as follows: 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt, and 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and sustenance.
That's right, sustenance.
For his father on the journey. So he sent his brothers away, and as they departed, he said to them, do not quarrel on the journey.
Okay, so emboldened by Pharaoh, Joseph equips the brothers for the return journey. Now, his supply falls into two categories. There's two categories of supply here. What are they?
Sustenance and a gift.
Okay, it's essentials and a gift, okay? Sustenance and a gift. The actual provision for the journey, but again, a whole lot of swag, right? So a lot of stuff that he didn't have to swing back with him. So essentials for the journey and a bunch of gifts on top of that. Now, why does he do this? Why does Joseph pile on? Why does he bring all this other stuff back? Why does he send all this other stuff back?
In case they don't come back.
What's that?
In case they don't come back.
Yeah. That would be the cynical view, which I've been known to have from time to time. Yeah, that's possible. What else might come to mind?
Intent and integrity in the intent?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Just think more basic.
Persuade his father.
There you go, right. To convince his father, okay? I mean, come on. He's going to ask his father to do some important stuff here, right? He's got to do it. He's got to convince him from a distance. His fathers are not likely to what?
Believe him.
Believe the brothers, that's for sure. Okay, so the swag would communicate that, A, Joseph was a man of stature in Egypt, okay? This is a lot of goods. This is a large gift that he's sending back. Who had the wherewithal to provide for the family in a foreign land, and maybe to impress upon Jacob that God's hand was in the request to come down, okay? So he's kind of accomplishing a lot of things in this process. In other words, he was not showing off, but rather he's providing the necessary evidence to convince his father to abandon the land that God had promised him and commanded him to stay in. Okay, so there's a lot going on, right? He's going to ask him to leave the land that God had very clearly said what? Don't leave. Okay, so he's going to have to bring some compelling evidence that God's hand is in this to get Jacob to leave, because Jacob hasn't left so far. Right? He's just left. He sent things down. His forefathers kind of were a little quicker to leave at certain times. Now, one more thing. Why does Joseph tell his brothers not to quarrel on the way?
Because they've been quarreling the whole lifetime.
They've been quarreling all their lifetime, yeah. But specifically, what would they possibly be quarreling about?
What Benjamin got.
Yeah, well, that could be that, right? Yeah, but that doesn't seem to really be the focus of this particular thing. It could be jealousy again, right? That's possible. Okay, but I think something probably more to what's going to have to happen when they get back.
Confess to the father.
Yeah, there you go, okay? They're going to have to tell their father and come clean, okay, with Jacob to get him to come to Egypt. Yeah, Ken.
What is interesting, later on, we're going to see that they don't. This text doesn't really tell us that they came clean with him.
I think it's going to tell us it did. Hold that thought.
Okay.
I think it's going to tell us they did. Okay. But because they're going to have to come clean with Jacob. Okay. And I think the text will support it in just a second. I'll show you how I get to that. Okay. So that would be quarreling about, right? Oh yeah, it was your idea. No, it was your idea. No, it was your idea, right? So they're all going to be trying to play the not me ghost in this game and go through it. Bobby.
I was thinking it could have been worse. They wanted to kill him.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, could be. So a lot of interesting things there. Okay, now, they could have easily been reduced to petty bickering over who was more at fault in the process. Boyce offers an interesting thought, James Montgomery Boyce. He's a good commentator out of the Philadelphia area with the Lord these days, but he calls this Joseph's Old Testament equivalent of the New Commandment in John 13:34. What's the New Commandment say? Yeah, okay. Love the Lord your God, but love one another as even as I have loved you. Okay, so guys, we've all made up. Everything's good. I've forgiven you. Okay, now you love me and each other the way that I have loved you in this process as he goes on. So kind of an interesting thought. Now, the time for deceit and quarreling is over, and now it's time for them to reunite as a family. 25 to 28. Somebody, I'm sorry. Yeah, question.
I have a question. Why didn't he give Benjamin more than the other brothers?
Because it's his true brother.
Yeah, probably because it's his blood brother. I mean, I don't really know, but it's the first time he's seen Benjamin probably in a long, long time. It is his blood brother. Okay, so it is his blood brother through his mother Rachel. So I suspect it's continuing to do that. Previously, I think it was to set the brothers up and test their hearts, okay? So as we dealt with it earlier, make sure they're not going to have the same level of jealousy towards Benjamin. But here, I think he's just reflecting, hey, this is my blood brother, and I'm giving him more, okay? So nothing more than that, I think. Bobby?
No reason to think that the younger brother had an easy life with these boys either, because they didn't like Joseph, they wouldn't like him either.
They probably didn't like him much either. Absolutely right. I mean, his father wasn't really making it easy for either of those kids, right? But obviously they decided to deal with it a little differently this time, okay? Or perhaps Benjamin stayed closer to home, as we learned in those other situations. Yeah, yeah.
The other piece of it, too, is that it's going to make more of an impression on his dad.
Yeah, could be. Yeah, could be. But he also sent a bunch of stuff for his dad as well.
But
so,
I mean,
yeah. So, well, that could be. That's actually a good point because, why would Benjamin have gotten more if it really wasn't Joseph? Because
right.
He's his blood brother. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a good example. So another example might be to also further impress his father. you know, because Benjamin is singled out amongst all the brothers to get more. It would be just another small piece of evidence to Jacob that this really was Joseph, his blood brother. So I think a couple of reasons like that. Okay, good addition. All right, somebody read 25 to 28 for me, please.
So they went up out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. They told him, Joseph is still alive. In fact, he is the ruler of all Egypt. Jacob was stunned. He did not believe them. When they told him everything Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts Joseph had sent to carry them back, the spirit of the father Jacob revived. And Israel said, I am convinced my son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die.
Okay, so now we have this second stunning revelation. First, the brothers learned that Joseph is alive in verse 3. And now Jacob learns the same thing in verse 26 and is understandably stunned, right? I mean, he's shocked. He just doesn't really know what to say. Now, what is Jacob's first reaction? What's his first reaction?
Does not believe the brothers.
Yeah, I mean, I picked out the word incredulity, okay? Who knows what other attendant emotions, but he was just flat out incredulous that, boy, these brothers are really treacherous. Where do they come up with this one? They're going to give me false hope that my long-lost son, whom I loved, is alive, right? So kind of incredulity. I mean, he just doesn't know what to say. Yeah, Matthew.
Just to add one thing, not only is he alive, but indeed he's ruler over all the land of Egypt.
Yeah, exactly, right. So if him being alive wasn't enough, how do you process that he's the big dog, you know, in vernacular in Egypt? Yeah, Ken.
You know, they went through this elaborate scenario to show their father that he was actually dead. They brought the cloth with the blood on it, and they said, in Jacob's mind, you know, he is dead.
Right.
And the brothers really didn't know one way or the other until.
Right.
They just know.
Yeah. You just know he was sold off. Right.
They went through this long, elaborate thing to let dad know, hey, he's really dead.
Right.
So in Jacob's mind, he is dead.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is even more stunning than what the brothers experienced when he revealed himself.
Exactly right. Okay, so we just see a whole bunch going on there. So the brothers' first approach to convincing their father was personal testimony. Okay, they just wanted their dad to take it on their word. He's alive, and he is in charge of everything down in Egypt, right? So, now, or of which testimony Jacob is rightly skeptical, and I'm sure that the brothers had hoped that their word alone would win the day, right? Now, why would they have hoped that that would win the day?
Good question, since they lied to begin with.
Yeah, right, right. But why would they hope that that would have been enough for their father? Why would they would have hoped that he would say, really? He's alive?
Right. They didn't want to have to confess.
Yeah, they're not going to want to confess, okay? They can still kind of hold their sin in and just hope that his joy over learning his son is alive is going to carry the day, right? All right, so Jacob would be so joyful so as not to ask any pesky questions, right? But it wasn't, so what happened next? What was plan B?
They had to tell him everything.
Okay, now say that, how does that, that's in verse what?
26.
27, okay. Okay, so what does it say? Who's got a NASB out there?
Mine says,
when they told him all the words of Joseph.
Okay. Okay, and what does yours say?
But when they told him everything Joseph had said to them.
Okay. Now, I made an assertion to Ken a minute ago that I think we can support it. So how do we support it for that statement? Okay, so they recounted all the words Joseph had spoken. So what does that imply?
That they confessed.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. So what were the words that Joseph had spoken?
God sent me before you to preserve you a remnant of the earth.
You did harm to me, but God did this for
right.
you.
Right. No, God's but go good. Back. Go back even further. Okay. What did he say in?
That he forgave them.
No. Right. Okay, verse 4, what does it say? I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold. It said they had to tell their father everything that Joseph had said.
Right.
All means what?
All.
Unless it doesn't mean all. I know Matthew's laughing. Why? Okay. But all generally means all. There are times that it has some delimiters on. Okay, I can say all of you, and I don't mean all the people in the world, right? So it does have a contextual thing. But here it says all the words that Joseph had spoken. What did Joseph speak? I am your brother Joseph, right? The one that you sold. Okay? So they had to disclose it. Give me a half a point on that one.
For me, it's half a point. I understand what you're saying.
Okay. So why is it only a half a point for you?
Well, think of these brothers and what their track record has
been. Yeah, okay.
I mean, you know, all in their mind could be just the good parts of what, which in fact Egypt was known for, the way they historically kept records.
Yeah.
Was they didn't told you the good stuff.
That's right.
So,
that's right.
You know, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's fair.
Would be half a point.
Okay, half a point. I'll take a half a point. That's fair, because you're right. I mean, you know, in Egyptian history, one of the problems with the dating, just a second, Matthew, is that there is no record of this famine in Hebrew and in Egyptian record, because they only did report the good stuff. Yeah, Matthew.
Well, since we are speculating, I would say that the journey back, part of the conversation was the marvel at God's provision and that he loved them enough to not let them get away with their own sin.
Yeah.
So at this point, I think they were humbled to the place where the other half pointed if they did confess, otherwise, man, they'd still be skating on thin ice.
So if anybody else doesn't think Matthew has a gentle heart, there's a gentle heart all along. I'd be cynical. He's saying, well, maybe they finally got it and they were really genuine, humble. And yeah, I think so. Okay? Look, a lot's going on in here, okay? And there's an awful lot of things that are going on in these processes. But I do think it implies that they did actually have to do revealing, okay? They had to admit their duplicity. So how do you know how am I going to convince my father this is really the one? And they just had to come clean with everything. So we never get an explicit detail of confession. But I think there was probably some sense of unavoidable confession here, because they had to do something to try to convince their father that this wasn't true, in fact true, given their track record of deception in the past. Now, what clinches the deal for Jacob? What clinches the deal? Okay, so he's going to hear all the words that are spoken. Okay, so what does it do? What happens next? So Joseph, when they told him all the words that Joseph had spoken, and then what else?
He saw
the wagons.
Yeah.
Okay, now, why are the wagons a big deal?
Because they didn't have the wagons before.
Yeah, okay. They're uniquely Egyptian, okay? There were no wagons anywhere else, and the father's got to be convinced here that there's no way these guys could have connived to bring this about. Mm-hmm. What did they have to sell and buy a bunch of wagons with? Okay, so the wagons were kind of an influential piece of physical evidence of where he was. Okay, for Jacob it was decisive. That said, I think it's the cumulative effect of their witness, their full disclosure, and their wagons. And in the end, what that did was revive Jacob's spirit and change his outlook from gloom to hope. Okay, so now Jacob has this hope. And it says at the end here that then Israel said, okay, Israel. Now Israel is what? That's Jacob's, yeah. That's his new name given to him by God. That's when he's, you know, behaving as God's anointed, God with me, okay? So after this, to triumph in Israel, he who strives with God says, enough talking, my son's alive. Let's make haste to get down and see him before I die. Okay, so kind of an interesting exchange there. You know, kind of closing the chapter, and I think if you think about this whole narrative, I'm always struck by the lengths that God will pursue, right, to accomplish something seemingly small, right? What'd he do? What did he do here? It's a worldwide famine to move one 70-person family to new quarters, right? Pretty interesting, right? A worldwide famine to get 70 people from here to here in his overall plan. I relate this Deborah incident. You know, one of the experiences that we had in China, you know, you're over there serving, and you don't always know whether you're accomplishing anything when you're out there on the mission field. You know, you feel like you're pounding your head against the wall from time to time to time to time. And Matthew will remember this name, perhaps Deborah. This is the gal. Remember the time when I wrote you guys. But we were in Shanghai, and we've been ministering to this one church where we're trying to help them build a leadership structure and put a male structure in there and find a biblical ecclesiology. And we had this monster problem with a gal named Deborah, who's probably, I don't know, she's probably worth a couple $100 million. Okay, so she's super wealthy, and that's a big deal for people in China. And she had been one of the elders. Now, that's already not a good picture. And I'm trying to help them understand how they should be structuring the church. So you can imagine Deborah has not got fond feelings for Stevie, who's telling what they need to do. Well, Deborah was just, she made the brothers look kind of clean in terms of how they would do things. She was pretty sneaky, right, Katie? Is that fair to say? I won't get into all the, Machiavellian detail because there was a lot of it. But basically, she was acting as a church within the church. Okay, she had her little group of people and whatever they said. So, this group of men had just become elders. There were five of them. And I said, guys, this is sin. We have to address it. And I'm telling you what, it was not a pretty time for these guys. It was hard for them beyond belief in the process to do it. You have to understand that women are pretty dominant in the church in China. So it's not an uncommon thing to see women in pastorate or leadership positions in the church in China. And I was saying to these guys, hey, look, it's sin. You're elders now. The first thing you're going to have to do as elders is you have to address this, or you're not going to have any integrity. Now, what had happened was they gave the vision for the church, which was to plant other churches. And they just did about 2 months ago, kind of a soft plant. They took a bunch of people and moved them to another big part of the city, and they planted a church, which was, very gratifying to hear. But when this gal heard this kind of vision, she popped up and said, we would like to be the first. We'll be the ones that'll go out. Well, that was all nice on the surface. But the fact is, she's been looking for a reason to take them out of the church all along. And I said, and they were saying, oh, yeah, that's great. That's perfect. We don't have to deal with Deborah anymore. And I said, whoa, guys, you can't do that. You can't do that. That's not integrity. You know she's not doing it for that kid. Well, long story short, it really became a challenging situation. I had gotten to know the leadership of the church here a bit on one of our trips back, and they were very helpful, combination of Matthew and Colin and Mark, and I don't know if Eric was in it at that point in time, and Matthew. They gave me helpful advice to go back, but the key thing you have to do when you're in a disciplined situation is you have to define the sin, okay? Mark was quite particular this morning to be very clear about why discipline was being implemented. Okay, you have to bring clarity to that. There have to be biblical reasons for it. And again, this is a society that saving face is a big deal. Okay, so they're just trying to find a way to save face and let it happen. And I just remember kind of overwhelmingly, and it was tough. I mean, we got hammered by some big, big names that were in China, one of which was Hudson Taylor's great-great-great-grandson, who just came in and hammered us. Another guy came in and went after the elders one time. And, of course, I kind of lost my patience with that. And the little pit bull came out. But it was good for them because they got to see somebody stick up for them in the process. And it was sin. And nobody wanted to call it sin. But all of that is to say that I was thinking back on our time in China, and Katie and I were reflecting as we were going through this. There was lots of pillow talk during that time, I can tell you. Because every night we're doing the right thing, we're doing the wrong thing. Do the right thing, we're doing the wrong thing. Right thing, wrong thing. We didn't get a whole lot of sleep. But the fact of the matter was, I was thinking about all the things that we may have been in China for, and it may very well have been that God had parachuted us in for that one situation. And the thing I've got to tell you, that's now how many years old, Katie? How many? Is that 2 years old now? These guys have hung tough. They sent her out. They disciplined her. It was nasty beyond all belief. There was all kinds of stuff. They have something called WeChat. That's their equivalent of messaging system, and stuff was flying all over WeChat. She threatened to turn us into the government authorities and all those different kinds of things. But the fact of the matter is they hung tough. They stayed. Their integrity was established. Those men are leading that church today. They've planted a church. They've trained additional men to be in the pulpit. And it's all God's grace. But, you think of how God will do something. And it was just one experience we've had. We had many in China. It wasn't us. It was just the fact that God chose to use us at that particular time. And if we did nothing else in those 8 years that we were in China, actually something for the church, God happened. So just like in this situation, God will move mountains to accomplish what seems like small things. And it just was a refreshing time. Anything you would like to add to that, Katie? Or?
Which one?
Anything you'd like to add to that? She wasn't always on my side in the process. Well, mostly she was.
And just trust in the Lord, trust in His words. Mm-hmm. And we just stick to the word. Matthew 18. When we had a lot of pressures from those big names with and rich people, and we said, what do we believe? Do we believe God? Do we believe His words? Or we yield to those pressures.
Yeah, yeah. So it is kind of funny. I mean, China's a simple place, so I'm a poor no name, and there are rich big names, and that's just a society that does it. But God, in His grace, I mean, He brought that. He gave those men the strength to do it, and it was really something. So, as we close the chapter, we kind of see the complete fulfillment of Genesis 37, and the stage is set for the events that will lead us to the books of Exodus. But for me, the big takeaway is this, and that is the pattern that Joseph provides for responding to difficulties, which is what? What's Joseph's simple pattern for responding to all the trials that he dealt with in his life?
Trusting God.
Yeah, trusting God. Keep your eyes firmly fixed on God. And really, that is the only thing you have as you're going through this. Now, it's a pretty good ace in the hole, okay? But the fact of the matter is, it really is all you have as you go through that process. Now, of course, we didn't get nearly as far as we went on. I just want to introduce the next section, and we'll stop there, okay? So those are people that, if you've never seen that, there's a group that we worked with in the Northeast. A bunch of house church leaders. What does their little heart thing say in Chinese there, Katie? Jesus loves you. So those are sketchboards in the background there. We taught them how to do sketchboard evangelism. And they say you can't do it in China. Well, they went out in the public square and they proclaimed the gospel up in the northeast of China. So it was really pretty interesting. So the little red and white things is a rope trick thing they can do. And then they had those different sketchboards where they actually went out and shared the gospel. So it's pretty amazing. And they've since kept doing that. And they've taken these sketchboards further and they take them out into the villages. And they show up in the villages and set up the sketchboard and start telling the story. So kind of a fun thing.
Not to belabor a point, but there are an awful lot of women in that group.
Yeah, there's only three guys.
Yeah. That's China right there, let me tell you. That is switching. So you can be very clear that my heart was to try to raise up men for ministry in China. Mm-hmm. And so typically, you know, the women are all separated in the rooms. The men are on one side and women. So the men got one little skinny line and the women are all over here. So it was always a challenge, but God gives us, some of us, stubborn personalities, and sometimes it helps. All right, so just a quick intro here, then we'll kind of pick this up in 2 weeks. It's a good place to start. So we're going to kind of head into this final section here, okay, 46 to 50. And we're going to mark the beginning of the final act here in Genesis. The nation is going to be resettled in Israel, and the patriarchal leadership is going to reach its end. Okay, so up to now, God has been ruling through patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Okay, Joseph is often mentioned, but it's really Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are the three patriarchs. And it's going to give way to this theocratic leadership where God's going to rule through His appointed leaders, okay? As we move on, the first and foremost of whom is going to be Moses, right? So Moses is going to be the big one as we move into Exodus. Also marks the time, the beginning of our end in Genesis, okay? I got to think about what we're going to do next, all right? But the fact is, we've spanned almost 2 years and about 60 lessons. And it has been a rich time for me. I hope it's been a joy for you. I've taught 1 to 11 a lot of times, but I've never really gone through the whole book. So thank you for your patience. It's been fun to go through the whole book. It really has been a joy for me. As we get a little closer to the end, I will map out what I'm thinking about doing next. Now, we're not congregational rule here, but we'll be a little congregational as we talk about it. I'll give you a couple of options. There's kind of a direction I want to go, but if you need a little break, we can look at a couple of other options as well. But big picture of these final chapters, 46 to 47, 12 is going to be their resettlement in Egypt. 46, 13 to 26 is going to be Joseph's leadership and legacy. 47, 27 to 48 is going to be Joseph's portion. And then 49 to 50, 14 is going to be Joseph's prophetic blessings. And then the final section will be the magnanimous pardon yet again. Okay, so Joseph's going to reinforce it. So this is where the chapter breaks are not always where we'd like them to be, but I'm kind of trying to move through the flow of thought. So that's where we'll go. Next week, we're going to have Matthew. I think it'll be terrific. learn more. I actually wish I could be here next week to hear that, but I'll be here for the 4 weeks that he'll share with us in July to do that. So please turn out for that. And if you would also be praying for Mark and I as we go to Haiti, that we will have a good, rich ministry and we'll come back in one piece.